Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is South African poet and journalist Ankie Krog. Born into a prominent Afrikaner family, while still a teenager, Krog became famous for penning an anti-apartheid poem with the line, "Give me a land where black and white, hand in hand, can bring peace and love to my beautiful land." Krog would quickly establish herself as one of South Africa's leading Afrikaans poets, even as she taught in a teacher's training college for blacks. It was the part that Krog played in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, however, that propelled her to international fame. She was the lead radio reporter for the award-winning South African Broadcasting Company on the TRC. As such, she was the voice that communicated daily the horrors that were part of the public spectacle of truth-telling aimed at reconciliation. Her brilliant memoir, Country of My Skull, which was about guilt, sorrow, and the limits of forgiveness in the new South Africa, was published in 1998. It has become one of the defining monuments on the meaning of the TRC. Krog was in Memphis for two lectures at Rhodes College in November, and this conversation was recorded as a part of that visit. Ankie, since the issues raised in the TRC are hardly distant to those of us living in Memphis, least of all me, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Counterpoint.
Hi, Jonathan.
Ankie, your parents and your family are invoked in Country of My Skull as emblematic of one group of Afrikaner voices who experienced the transition from a racist South Africa to what some have termed the Rainbow Nation. Tell us a little about your family and your upbringing.
I grew up on a farm as one of five children. My father was a sheep farmer. My mother was a writer. She was a journalist, but she wrote popular fiction for women magazines. She read a lot, so there was a lot of books and of all variety of languages and cultures in our house. I had a normal, conservative, Afrikaner upbringing, I would say.
Expand a little. What does it mean to say a normal, conservative, Afrikaner upbringing?
It wasn't overly racist. The racism was hidden, was normalized in the sense that you know why they live in that mud house at the back, because they don't feel cold. If they were like us, you know, shivering in the winter, then of course one would have given them other houses, but they don't, and they don't love their families as white people do. That's why they love you white kids such a lot and look after you and go with you on holiday, because for them, all children are like their children. So in that sense, the racism was normalized, but never crude and hurtful in a way.
You're very much describing the experience that I grew up with as well. I mean, I grew up with servants who lived in exactly those kinds of conditions. And I actually grew up with far more stereotypes about Afrikaners, let's say, than I did about blacks, precisely because blacks were in this subservient position that was completely normal for them. So as an Afrikaner, can you talk a little bit more about some of the ways in which you grew up with ideas about other so-called whites or other Europeans in South Africa?
Grunstadt was a small town, and my family moved in there in 1825. So they were of the first white people who established themselves next to a river. Grunstadt lies on the banks of a river. So we've been there for generations, and we know the farms that belong to my family. But then there was a very good high school, Grunstadt High School, and that school had an English section. And within the English section were English-speaking people of the Catholic and the Methodist and Anglican Church. But there were then also Jews, because in the small towns there were several shops that belonged to Jewish people. And it was quite strange. You would have a meeting of the whole school that they open with prayer, etc., and then the Jewish kids would go outside. And then one see them laughing and standing outside and talking, and you think how you envy them in a way, that they're so loose, perhaps, from what is coming down forcefully on you from the stage. Also, the expectations of Afrikaner children of how to behave, of how to be the best, of how to be better than the English, because the Afrikaner has this obsession to show that you are as good and better than the English. That Jewish people were, in a way, also loose from that. And now when I come across them, we talk about these days, about how I envied them. And then they would say how they envied me or us because we so belonged. They had to stand outside, but we so belonged. But to explain how absolutely nothing I knew about race, in a way, in terms of Jewishness, when I was standard 9, I played in a youth orchestra and we went to Cape Town and I went into a shop and I bought a poetry volume there of somebody with the name of Leonard Cohen. And I read it and I was completely bowled over. Oh. So when I arrived home, I said to my father, "Oh, I've discovered this fantastic poet." And my father took the volume and he looked at it and said, "It's a Jew." And I thought, you know, my father knows everybody. He absolutely knows everybody. I mean, my father is an expert on surnames. So you just say a surname and he would exactly know that, you know, even I can buy in a foreign city a volume and he would know it's a Jew.
You start understanding on the basis of the way a name indicates everything about a person, what the meaning of it was to live in a place in which race was ever present and yet denied all the time. Before we get into discussing Country of My Skull in more detail, can you give us a brief overview of the TRC? How did it come into being? What was carried out under its auspices? And what made the TRC different from other Truth and Reconciliation commissions that came before it and even those that followed from it?
When a country wants to move from a dictatorship to a democracy, or in the case of apartheid, to a democracy, the thing that guides it is what we call transitional justice. So you have to take the same people, the very same people that were dictators and suffered under a dictatorship, you now have to move into a democracy. Now that transitional justice ethos, one of its tools is a truth commission. And a truth commission forms then part of what they call restorative justice. You get two main kinds of justices, a retributive justice in which you punish people, and then you get restorative justice in which you try to restore what went wrong. So this is the intellectual logic behind it. But there's all kinds of stories. For example, they were writing the interim constitution. All the formerly banned parties and the Afrikaners and people inside the country were writing an interim constitution to guide the election so that we can vote our leaders in and then that leaders would write our new constitution. So when they have finished this interim constitution, which would then be the door to a democracy, someone asked, who's going to protect this election? And someone said, well, the police and the army, yeah, but they were from the previous powers. If they know that you are going to put them on trial after the election, you are going to punish them, they will not protect the election. So we must write something in so that they know they can protect the election and they will be reasonably okay afterwards. And then that clause was put into the interim constitution that says a vehicle will be established to deal with former human rights violations in an atmosphere that is not focused on vengeance, but on ubuntu, on restoration and connectedness.
And in the course of the TRC, it started in 1996. How many cases? What were some of the numbers behind?
The South African Truth Commission was the 18th one, and it had major differences with the others, that people testified in public. In Chile, in Argentina, and all of those, people testified behind closed doors. The other one was that amnesty was individualized in those other countries and the countries around South Africa, like Zimbabwe and Angola and Namibia, as the previous perpetrators just got blanket amnesty. The third one, which was the most unusual one, I think, is that the mother whose son fought against apartheid and got killed sat next to the mother whose son fought for apartheid who got killed. So that you brought these two pasts together in a way to say that mother grieves the same. The commission had 17 commissioners. It had three committees. The Human Rights Violation Committee, which listened to the violation of human rights. And they took thousands of testimonies, I think between 22,000 and 25,000, and 2,000 testified in public. The Amnesty Committee is people who wanted to apply for amnesty. There were around 10,000 people, and only slightly more than 1,000 were given. The third one was the Reparation Committee, was supposed to draft a policy for government to repair what the people who suffered. The violations that the commission looked at was defined as gross human rights violations like murder, torture, kidnapping, and so forth. So it was not the land, it was not racism, it was not humiliation, it was none of those bigger and probably more harmful elements of apartheid.
Now, Anki, even though Country of My Skull is a powerful, hard-hitting, moving book, it's hardly a straightforward narrative. Its form is fragmentary, weaving together many different kinds of voices into the multifaceted exploration of what it means to come to terms with apartheid. And this is really part of what I love about the book, because it makes clear that it's not a black and white issue, and there are no clear-cut answers to what it all meant and the legacies and lessons that come from racial states. There are three main levels to your analysis, as I see it, and I want to parse each of these with you. The victims' stories, your reflections on how you were impacted by them, and then the larger philosophical questions that the process raises. So let's start with the victims, but let's do so with reference to the dedication of your book. It reads, "For every victim who had an Afrikaner surname on her lips." This is a very complicated dedication on many levels. Tell us why you chose to dedicate the book this way.
You must remember the book was written it wasn't meditated or mediated. It was gut response. Because for 2 years I reported as an ordinary journalist in the sense that myself must be absent, I must be neutral, etc., etc. And you can never deal with the fact of your own culpability, how you felt when particular things happened. And one of the strongest impressions that one had during those, and it's on a daily basis, are the many, 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 many women and how they described tiny households, precarious households with little food or a cloth or light or a floor, and how into this brutalization came, and always somewhere was an Afrikaner expression, an Afrikaans expression, always uttered, although they were testifying in their indigenous languages, then that bit would be in Afrikaans. And in the way in which it was expressed, I recognized that.
Fok of jy, nou gaan jy kak.
So immediately you understood that. So it was both the language that in a way made me a poet. What would I have been without that language? Then used in this way, and then mainly by women.
And the book is also an echo chamber of the victim stories. Cut and pasted into the text are these phrases, but also larger testimonies that came directly from the TRC hearings. So we hear repeatedly, of course, of resistance fighters who were brutalized by the apartheid state and its secret police, but also blacks who were horribly killed by what was termed necklacing by other blacks, as well as whites who were killed by ANC fighters. So teleport us for a moment into this echo chamber and what it was like to report on these stories. You've talked about that a little bit now in discussing the dedication, that you had to just be neutral and an observer and use the language of journalism, but it was impacting you in very powerful ways. So tell us a little about that.
Because of my father, I know the country very well. My father loved to travel and would take us and to unimportant places and explain to us the history that took place there. So I know the country, I thought, well. Now, with the Truth Commission process, we were traveling to those same places. And suddenly, in a hall that I've passed by often, another layer was exposed in that hall with the familiar surnames. And the brutalization, you soon realized, affected everybody. The way black people burnt one another, there was a whole session in one town that was called the capital of necklacing. And the one victim after the other describing the facial expression of someone who dies of burns. The one woman would say, his eyes turned another color. Another one would say, her nose became like a bird's beak. Another woman said that her hands became, from then on she was saved, as if it has orange peel. And she said, I can't feel my children. They stand around me and I want to touch their heads and I just have this peel inside my hands. So the maimedness of the country was profound, but behind it all was always us, in a way.
Part of what comes out in the book so powerfully is the way in which everybody was maimed. No one got away from a system that was structured in this way. Afrikaners were themselves traumatized and in fact even maimed through this process, even if not in nearly the same way. But listening to the survivor testimony partly helps one to understand that from the perspective of those who have been victimized, everyone in a sense, as you said earlier, everyone's grief is the same. The tears are the same kinds of tears. The ongoing effort to try to come to terms with this past is the same for the women sitting side by side, no matter which side they were on in this past. And again, the book cascades with these stories that are so powerful and moving. But a second level of your book is your self-interrogation of the culture and traditions of your upbringing. Let's get at this by discussing the title of the book. The one time it comes up in the narrative is almost in the middle of the book. Would you just read that passage?
And suddenly it is as if an undertow is taking me out. And behind me sinks the country of my skull like a sheet in the dark. And I hear a thin song, hooves, hedges of venom, fever and destruction fermenting and hissing underwater. I shrink and prickle against my blood and the heritage thereof. Will I forever be them, recognizing them as I do daily in my nostrils? Yes, and what we have done will never be undone. It doesn't matter what we do until the third and the fourth generation.
So given this passage, tell us a little about why the book is called Country of My Skull.
It has both the connotation of imagination, and that is that the country that you imagined. But then skull has its as a death mask, so it's also the country of death, and that brought death and visited death on its inhabitants.
For me as well, part of what I found powerful is that you're really trying to work out. I mean, you reference this with respect to the language and the way in which the language itself has been contaminated by this past, but it's also the culture. In this passage alone, you're talking about coming to terms with your own heritage, with your blood, that it's in your bones, that it has literally shaped your skull. And that's part of what you're wrestling with in the book.
Part of my upbringing is, of course, the Anglo-Boer War, in which the British fought the Afrikaners in 1900s and used the first concentration camps of the 20th century. So in those camps, family of mine, 26,000 Boer children and women died. So I was raised on this notion that Afrikaners stood up even if it's against the empire. You stand up if something is right, even if you know you don't have a chance. So there's no opportunism in it. It's just when it's right, you do it. Now, of course, out of that, the Anglo-Boer War, the Afrikaners collected affidavits from many of the women and children to take the British to the international court because they have violated the Geneva Convention. Then for the sake of reconciliation, it was decided not to take them. So those stories of the Boer women and children were kept in vaults for 78 years. There was this provision, only then you could open them. So the Anglo-Boer War was never talked openly about. So it was internalized and it was mythologized. And the big mythology then comes that everyone was brave. Everyone knew what was right. And you must look after yourself because the world will always turn against you. So even if you do something unjust, it doesn't matter. It is this survival that you have. Only you will be able to secure the survival. Now, you sit in front of the Truth Commission, where then everything that you have grown up of what Afrikaners are betrayed. It was for benefits, it was for more land, just to be able to take, just to be able to suppress. And there you sit. So the very soul of your identity is actually then rotten to its marrow.
And when you talk about the ways in which this process of the Boer War becomes mythologized, part of what you're trying to call for in this book is actually what the Truth and Reconciliation itself was supposed to bring about, which is this movement from a mythologized view of the past towards truth that may itself open up the possibility of reconciliation. So let's use that to turn towards the third level of the book, which explores a whole series of philosophical questions that are raised by the very terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, concepts like truth and reconciliation and amnesty and just wars and guilt and shame and trauma and memory and forgiveness. And I could go on with this list, and you parse them and contemplate them and grapple with them. We won't have time to raise all the issues that the book poses, but let's at least consider some of them. And let's start with truth. The last line of the book, which is the last line of the acknowledgments, you write this: I've told many lies in this book about the truth. I've exploited many lives and many texts, not least those of my mother and my family on the farm. I hope you will all understand. What are you exploring here about the nature of truth-telling when you say that you've told lies about truth?
That is a separate and technical debate, but I want to return to the word truth. One of the advantages of truth-telling in front of a commission is that you begin to hear stories, and a story never has one focal point and one vocality. It is always different layers that comes through, which complexify your sense of what was happening. Now, these stories that was collected after the Anglo-Boer War has been open now, and I went through a whole lot of them. And what is extraordinary in those stories is also how kind some of the British people, the soldiers, were towards these women on the farm. So this interaction of two human beings, of sharing milk or asking for water, or say, wait, I'll not burn the house, you can take or remove the piano before you burn the house. It prevents you from making oversimplified and dangerous conclusions and abuse them to get somewhere else. And I think this is the most wonderful thing of the Truth Commission stories, is the way in which white and black also had some kindness. Somewhere in between all of this, there were moments of
Humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems that one of the things that your book seethes with is a certain frustration on the part of the Afrikaner leadership in particular to itself come before the commission. There's all kinds of resistances and ways in which it ends up being sort of just manipulated through political processes or through the political parties. And in a way, your own testimony stands in for the ways in which you continue to hope that Afrikaner leaders throughout the country will themselves come before the commission. So can you talk a little bit about that frustration and the ways in which it continues to linger for you in thinking about South Africa post-apartheid now?
You know, I was obsessed with Ayn Rand when I was at university, and this whole issue of individualism and selfishness, and that you despise weakness and softness and that you would be enough for yourself, etc. Part of my being was to be not dependent and to be self-sufficient. And the Truth Commission was an unbelievable shock, because in front of me were illiterate black people who were saying things and describing things that I know I don't know of a single white person who could say this, who could move to this space of profoundness. And all of it was embedded in a complete being connectedness with one another. And that filtered not only through the testimonies, but from the testimonies to the staff of the Truth Commission, to us who were reporting on it. It was a kind of humane space that was created that I felt like I've arrived at water, at oxygen. And I was wondering, how is it possible that people who have not gone to school, who have not read what I have read, arrived at these spaces of humaneness? And it's through studying, when I was appointed at the University of the Western Cape, I went back to the testimonies and began to sort of study and analyze them and got the original ones and look at them. When you began to realize that behind that is this, what I call an ontology of being interconnected. And that interconnectedness is not only with my mother or my family or those with the same skin color, but that it is a complete connectivity. That if you hurt, it affects me. And if you did something wrong and I take revenge on you and kill you, then that hurt that happened in me because you were hurt can never heal. So it's part of the imperative in myself is to help you heal so that I can be humane again. My family would say, you know, these blacks, too useless to hate. You know, if we did to them, if they did to us what we did to them, we would hate them for generations. You know, my mother would say, oh, the Russians, they can hate properly. There's an admiration for hate and revenge. People who can take revenge as the real admirable people. And I mean, here in your country, with the death of Osama bin Laden, there was that sense of justice. It's been very challenging to be with people who has the moral imagination to think that people should change and that by killing someone, you stay in that frozen harmedness.
And Anki, it seems that part of what is so difficult is the very difficulty of overcoming that harmness. At the end of the book, there's a short poem, and the book is strewn with your poems in various places, and even the prose language is very poetic. Let's turn to that passage at the end and read that short poem, which in many senses, I think, sums up a lot of Country of My Skull.
So much hurt for truth. So much destruction, so little left for survival. Where does one go from here? Voices slung in anger over the solid cold length of our past. How long does it take for a voice to reach another in this country held bleeding between us?
Anki, I want to end our discussion by moving from the country bleeding between us back to Memphis and by extension the United States. There are some in America who claim that the election of a black president and 60 years after the end of Jim Crow segregation, that our American version of apartheid is over and that it's time to stop talking about that past and to stop talking about race in an ostensibly post-racial America. Your bid in Country of My Skull is that reconciliation and truth and perhaps deeper healing, the ontology of interconnectedness, as you've put it, cannot come until all the voices have been heard, all the pain aired, all the wounds attended to, all the compromises owned up to. Only then can South Africa be a rainbow nation. Do you think that there are lessons there for America as well?
I'm always careful to suggest that other countries should follow anything that South Africa did, especially as the African-American race discourse have meant a lot for the struggle discourse in South Africa. But after 1994, it has become problematic because now you have a majority minority, different kinds of, and black people do have the majority of power. So it becomes problematic to still link that. I'm just surprised at the lack of a moral imagination in the States, in the way in which retributive justice is the only justice that people think about and assume if you do that, then everything else is actually okay. So if that debate on race in this country is simply in terms of a retributive justice. I mean, I think you can restore here and there financially, but it would not really change fundamentally the soul of the country. You need a humaneness in a way.
It seems to me that part of what we get is that, in a sense, the moral imagination requires a literary imagination. It requires poetry and attention in the way that your book does to the multivocal, multi-layered, many-voiced versions of coming to terms with the past. Anki Krog, was such a pleasure to have you with us today on Counterpoint.
It's a pleasure, Jonathan.
I'm Jonathan Judakin. For more discussions with intellectuals and academics who are helping to reshape our public conversation, the key issues we face locally and globally, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the Counterpoint link listed under the news menu item and sign up for the podcast to be downloaded automatically to your favorite listening device. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.